It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. We are starting to get into the actual hot stove season. We're starting to get some transactions. We're starting to get the slightest feel for where guys are going to go. So we've got a little more to talk about as far as 2017 than we have had previously when it was a lot of speculation. And we will start with some moves. I think maybe we start actually with qualifying offers because there were a couple of guys who accepted, and I think they're both pretty interesting. Neil Walker accepts, returns to the Mets as their primary second baseman. Two questions, I think, when it comes to Walker, and one is, how much confidence do you have in him, given that there are some real health questions about him, but the Mets were at least confident enough to be willing to pay him $17 million? And two, is there anybody from that mix of guys who was looking like they'd have a shot at second base that you still like, Wilmer Flores, Rivera, any of those guys?
Yeah, I'd say starting with Walker, I am a little bit worried about his back heading into next season, but I don't think in a mixed league you wouldn't have to pay the price for him that would make it so that, you know, he would ruin your year if he had a back injury. You know, I like what I see with the power with him and the Mets. It's interesting that Daniel Murphy kind of started trending in a powerful direction near the end of his time with the Mets, and then Walker kind of came in and picked right up where he left off and would have easily posted, you know, a career-high home run, totally tied it. He would have posted easily had he stayed healthy. So I feel like he's a mixed-league second baseman, but not in the first, you know, 10 or 12 rounds, kind of in the second half of a draft because there's no speed there, and the batting average will be fine but not great. Among the others, I guess we'll just have to see where everything shakes out, but I'm not that excited about any of the rest of those candidates. Like, I still like first base, like Lucas Duda if he's healthy, but Flores, those guys, I'm not really excited for them for mixed leagues. Is there a name that kind of stuck out for you?
I mean, if Flores gets an opportunity somewhere, but he won't, I still have some optimism for him. I still think he can hit, but it doesn't look like there's going to be the opening. I mean, I just don't see where he would play. I mean, it's the Mets, and the Mets certainly have had their history of injury problems, so somebody could get hurt and open the door for him, and if so, I'm listening. But it's hard to see where that opening is with Reyes now on board. They you know, no matter what David Wright can give them, even if it's very little, I think that even if Wright's playing minimally, Reyes is now the guy who gets those at-bats at third base, and there's just not that opening anywhere in the infield. If anything, you almost feel like if there's an opening for Flores, it might be as the right-handed half of a first base platoon, or if things go poorly with Duda, he plays some first, or Walker slides over there. But yeah, there's just not really the opening right now.
Yeah, you're right, and that's probably the place for Flores. But and then when you start comparing him to first baseman,
right,
now, you know, I do think he could be, you know, a 20 to 25 home run hitter across the full season, and so if he's in a full-time role, he's kind of usable, but with him not stealing bases and having not yet hit really for average in the majors, like not a high average, then first base is still deep enough. I know it's not as deep as it used to be, but I think it's still deep enough that then he's just someone who starts the season on waivers in mixed leagues,
yep,
and maybe we pick him up at some point.
Yep. And then Jeremy Hellickson stays with the Phillies. You know, Hellickson was kind of a guy that you could really play the matchups with last year. You certainly didn't need to hold on to him at all times, but he had a real nice year, and you know, I think you can look at Hellickson a couple of ways. You can look at this as kind of the beginning of a comeback for him and maybe hope for more innings from him. I mean, he's still a relatively young guy. It's not like he was a total scrap heap pitcher. I think on the one hand, you could say maybe this is the beginning of a comeback. Maybe this guy becomes the sort of 2-3 type guy that it really looked like he'd be when he was younger. Or you say, boy, I'm not buying that again. That's what he had in him. And anything you get after this is gravy. I lean, I think, more towards the first than the second. Where are you on that?
Yeah, I'm kind of expecting maybe a little bit of regression, but I am expecting him still to be like kind of mixed league worthy next year. You know, he might fall in that category of pitchers that's a little more valuable to a real team than a fantasy team because his strikeout rate's just kind of mediocre. His control was outstanding last year, and I'm always a big fan of a player having a great year, and for him this is, you know, his best year in a long time, maybe ever. Well, maybe not ever, but I guess since 2011. having a great year and then just staying in the same situation where he's comfortable. So, you know, I could see a high threes ERA next year, you know, a decent whip, a decent strikeout rate. He wins double-digit games. I think it all adds up to someone who's like a back-end rotation guy in a 12-team league, or kind of like an in-and-out-of-the-rotation guy in a 10-team league. But I don't think he's I don't know. I don't feel like this is going way better. Like, I don't think we see like a 3.3 ERA or something next year. Like, do you think he could be better than he was in 2016?
I think he could. I wouldn't bet on it. To me, the question with Hellickson is the innings. I think the 189 he hit last year, this year in 2016, however you want to call it, was right at his career high. And the question is he a 180, 190 inning guy, or is he, with another full year back from his health issues, is he a guy you can figure maybe tops that, maybe pushes 200, 210? And that's the area where I wouldn't be surprised if he makes some real improvement. The Phillies are not going to have probably another real horse. The Phillies aren't likely to have that guy that they can say every time he goes out, it's going to get seven, going to rack up 220, 230 innings. And so, you know, I kind of feel like maybe some of those responsibilities fall on Hellickson. And in that case, I think the one thing you could see is a bump in the innings, and therefore a bump in the strikeout total, maybe a bump in the wins. That's kind of where I could see him taking a step forward. I could see the ratios basically holding steady and him giving you 10 or 20 more innings.
Yeah, and to piggyback off that optimism, I will say that, you know, his profile right now is great control, but a little homer prone. I mean, he's allowed over 20 home runs in 5 of the last 6 years, and the other season he allowed plenty of homers. He just wasn't in the rotation very long. He wasn't healthy very long. Those pitchers who have great control and give up, you know, a few too many home runs, they can go deep into games. So, I mean, he's not someone who's going to be just constantly, you know, walking this battle of walking batters and going deep into counts to get a strikeout. And, you know, and he pitches pretty well, but he only gives you 5 1/3. Like, he could be a consistent 7-inning pitcher who just gives up 1 or 2 homers every start, and that kind of decides whether he wins or loses. But you're right, that's how he could have more fantasy values, maybe the same ratios, 20 more innings, another win or two, and 15 more strikeouts.
We stay in the NL East, and we stay with veteran starting pitchers. R.A. Dickey and Bartolo Colon both go to the Braves. You know, it's hard to be that excited about anybody going to the Braves after last year, but, you know, I think I could see some bump from Dickey. I could see Dickey going from being a guy you'd almost never start to a guy where maybe you'd stream and find some matchups. And Colon, I kind of feel like he definitely loses some value. I'm not sure he loses that much. I'm not crazy about either of them, but I can see having each of them at various times next year. Are you kind of with me on that?
Yeah, I think Colon, I felt like, was a regression candidate, you know, no matter where he signed. I mean, his 3.43 ERA last year, but a 4.03 FIP. And he's not a pitcher who consistently, you know, far out-pitches his FIP. So he was probably a regression candidate anyways. I feel like they'll both hover around, like, a 4 flat ERA. I think maybe my takeaway for fantasy owners is right now I feel like there's this impression that Colon is much, much more valuable than Dickey, and they're probably a lot more similar than people are believing. But just on that recency bias of last season, if you look prior to last season, there's a lot of similarities between them. And you get Dickey out of the American League and out of Rogers Center,
right,
and home runs were a big problem for him. You know, I could see them having similar ERA, similar whip, but fantasy owners, I mean, in a 10-team league, they're probably not draft options, but in a 12 or a 15, I could see Colon going much higher and then not really being much more productive. And neither one has a great strikeout rate.
Yeah, that's the thing with Dickey is for him in particular, for a guy who can really be homer prone, Atlanta's not a bad place to hit home runs, but you get him away from the DH, you get him out of that ballpark, I can see a little spike for him. Dickey's previous club, note the clever segue here, the Toronto Blue Jays, just signed Kendrys Morales. And again, I'm sort of two minds here, because on the one hand, and I think we've talked about this, as a general rule, slugger signs with Toronto, I'm upping his value. It's a good place to hit. They seem to have a culture or something that brings out the best in sluggers and sometimes low OBP sluggers like Morales. I can see this working, but you go back over his recent years, he has one 30 home run season, I think, in the last five. He has more consistently been a 22, 23 home run guy. So if I tell you for Morales next year, 260, 25, and 90, one, do you think that's a pretty good read? And two, how much value does that have?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good read. Maybe he hits a little higher than 260, but I think, he's kind of part of this home run boom in baseball last season, really, when you look at his numbers. I mean, I know he had the 34 home run season way back in 2009, but he was kind of going along as a low 20s home run guy, and then boom, all of a sudden 30 last year. His OPS actually dropped, though, from 2015 to 16, so it's not like the power was, he just converted a bunch of doubles into home runs last season, so I feel like his home run total, I would have predicted to drop had he stayed in Kansas City pretty substantially. But now that he's in Toronto, you know, I might take the over on 25 home runs. Whether I take the over on 90 RBIs, I think depends on what else the Blue Jays do with their free agent period and trading in the offseason, because this is a decently strong indication that Edwin and Encarnacion won't be back. And if Batista isn't back, then I mean, you can't replace Encarnacion and Batista with Kendrys Morales and have the same quality of lineup that they've had in recent years.
And I think that's really the worry, and I think that's what stood out to me in reading the tea leaves was if the Blue Jays had signed a right fielder, you would say, well, we kind of knew Bautista was likely gone. They seemed far apart. You kind of felt better about Encarnacion returning all along. Okay, that's fine. They signed Morales. That pretty much pushes Encarnacion out the door. It's almost impossible to see how that works. And you still don't necessarily have any more confidence in Bautista because, again, I think conventional wisdom has been that he was gone almost no matter what. I realize we don't necessarily do sort of transaction analysis in this regard here, but it looks to me very much like you sign a DH. I'm not real confident either of those guys is back. What's the word sort of around there on those guys?
Yeah, I don't think they'll be back, but I do feel like the Blue Jays, looking at where their payroll is, and they look like they have money to spend, and corner outfield is usually, you know, one of the easier places to find productive hitters. So I feel like it won't be, I don't think it'll be Batista. It could be, we'll see what the market for him is like, but I could see them moving on some other corner. That's where they need players right now. They don't view Melvin Upton Jr. as a starting player for them, maybe a platoon guy. So they really need help in both corners. Usually you can find decent offensive players there, but just looking at their lineup for next season, like if Travis hits leadoff, if Donaldson hits second, I feel like there's this big hole third. You know, maybe Morales and Tulowitzki hit fourth and fifth, and then the bottom half's fine with some Russell Martin and Pilar and players like that, but they really need that guy to hit third. Now, the good news is that they should be able to find a corner infielder that can hit third if they're willing to pay for someone. I'm not sure if they'll jump in on a big-name guy. It doesn't seem to be the word on the street in Toronto and the history regarding this Blue Jays ownership group coming from Cleveland.
It would be awfully fun to see Cespedes hitting there, but let's not.
I have thought that many times, but nobody else seems to be talking about that. And I guess if you know, he is a younger power hitter. If they just want to get younger and change kind of the team a little bit, but nobody seems to be mentioning it. So I don't know. There's no smoke. There's no fire.
Yeah.
I guess
the Blue Jays also bring in Lourdes Gurriel, a very exciting young player. But talking to MLB.com's international expert Jesse Sanchez, Jesse told me, has written this as well, that Gurriel is not an imminent impact guy, partly because of his age and his just sort of on the development curve, but also because he's really rusty. Basically, upon signing, had not really played competitive ball since about February. So personally, my advice would be to be very, very conservative on Gurriel if you're talking about sort of keeper dynasty type leagues where you're picking him up for the long term, okay. But nearly any estimate you give me, I would say under for him in 2017. Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah, I mean, he's not. I wouldn't even draft him like in a 1-year AL only league.
Yeah,
I wouldn't draft him unless something changes in spring training. I mean, you never know. I was surprised that I thought he would get more money, to be honest. And again, now we're analyzing transactions, but I was surprised that he didn't get more money because the scouts do seem to be pretty high on his long-term potential. But for this season, the Jays seem pretty clear that he's going to start the year in the minors. I mean, maybe if he has a good minor league season, maybe we see him later in the season. I'd say the most optimistic view I could have of him would be he gets off to a nice start in AAA. Troy Tulowitzki gets injured, which would not shock anyone, and they need a shortstop, and they give him a shot, and that could happen, you know, who knows, in May or June. But barring a Tulowitzki injury, I don't think that we see him until later later in 2017. I think he's more of a 2018 discussion point.
One more free agent signing, Andrew Bailey, back with the Angels. Pretty good down the line last year. It's hard to have a lot of faith in Houston Street. If you are pegging the chances for saves in the Anaheim bullpen, you like Bailey as much as anybody?
I think on skills I like Cam Bedrosian the most. But Street has a contract, but I believe it's the last year that he's going into, so they don't really have to stay kind of married to him in the ninth inning. I feel like it's either Bedrosian or Bailey. I just don't feel good about Street coming off this season. I feel I wouldn't draft Bailey if I was drafting today, and I'm glad I'm not, but if I was, I wouldn't draft Bailey in a 10-team league. I would consider him in like the last round of a 12-team league. I think it'll shake out during spring training, and they will have a guy by opening day, but I might put him kind of second out of those three guys. How would you rank them right now, Street and Bedrosian and Bailey?
I'm kind of with you. I'm not really sure between Bedrosian and Bailey. I do know that I don't like Street until and unless I know Street is the guy. I'm just not that interested, only because at this point in his career, all he really does is saves if he gets them. I mean, this is not a guy where he's going to help you if he's not. No, I realize that's true of a lot of guys, but you look at Street, 57 strikeouts in 62 innings in 15, but, not really a big strikeout guy, 14 in 22 innings last year. I just don't have a lot of faith that he's going to help you if he's not getting saves. He's not the guy you'd hold on to as sort of a hedge. So between the other two, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty clear on Street being the third of those three.
Yeah, so I think that means unless something different happens in spring training, and they've already said that Street doesn't get handed the job and will have to earn it. You and I aren't really confident that he'll earn it. So I think unless something changes in spring training, if he's third, then he's not really draftable in any mixed league.
We moved to trades, and there have been a few interesting ones here. Howie Kendrick to the Phillies, who are going to play him apparently as an everyday outfielder, putting aside what a bizarre choice that seems. If he's playing regularly and still eligible at second base, is he a mixed league asset as your second baseman with the acknowledgement that there's no way in the world that he's a mixed league asset as an outfielder?
Yeah, and I think no, because second base is pretty deep right now, and middle infield's pretty deep overall. And if you're thinking, I do believe his batting average can rebound from the 255 he hit last year, but even if he could hit 285 or something, 10 homers and 10 steals, something along those lines, like it just, after the offensive season we just saw, it just doesn't really cut it. I think I would not really be excited or interested in drafting him in any mixed league. So to me, he's kind of someone that sits on waivers, and you need a guy for a week because one of your players is hurt, so maybe you pick him up and he won't hurt you, and you hope that you run into one of the weeks where he hits a home run and steals a base or something like that. But overall, I don't think I'd really draft him, and especially in the Phillies lineup, which will probably be below average again next year. Are you seeing him along the same way?
Yeah, I'm not a fan at all. I am utterly perplexed by the idea that this guy's an everyday outfielder, and I'm not really sure he's that much of a bat even as an everyday infielder, which he won't be. So weird move to me. The Angels bring in Cameron Maben, who is a guy, as a player, I like a lot. A guy I think does a lot of things well, is somebody who is still relatively young and somebody that I'd always like my team to be taking a flyer on. With that said, he's a lifetime 259 hitter who hit 315 last year. I am a lot more confident that he returns to 259 than that he comes closer to 315. And so I sort of feel like while Maben, I think, is a real asset as a baseball player, outfielder, a little bit of pop, a little bit of speed, can do a lot of things to help your team, I would rather let somebody else take the chance on him hitting 300 again. Do you think there's more reason than I do to think that he pushes that batting average again?
No, I don't. I mean, the BABIP was really high last year. It was 383. So, I mean, he's probably due to, yeah, to hit something in the 260 range this season. You know, whether he to me, he's like kind of on the fringe of a mixed league player. He's not a 10-team league player, but the one thing he has going for him is that he can steal bases. And if he stays healthy, which doesn't always happen with him, he could get you 20-plus steals, and steals are at a premium right now. To me, the tipping point for him will be whether he hits high in the lineup. Like, Tigers hit him second a lot last season. If he hits second in front of Trout and Pujols, I could see 20-something steals and plenty of runs. And, you know, that like that's just a commodity right now. We just could use guys who steal bases and could help you at least somewhat in some other categories. If he's hitting seventh, then to me, he's, you know, even borderline in a 15-team mixed league. Maybe in those leagues you look at him if you really need the steals. But health is becoming a bit of a concern for him. Like, he has, you know, last year was kind of a bit of the tipping point for me, because 2013-14 hadn't gone well from that perspective. But then 2015, he played 141 games. So you think, okay, maybe he's moved past it. And then it crept back in last year. So now it comes back to something I mentioned with Neil Walker earlier also, though. If you don't have to invest much in Maven, right, then you just, if he fits your lineup, you ride him while he's healthy, and then you put him on your DL when he isn't, or cut him when he isn't. So, I mean, you're not investing an early round pick in him. It's just whether you need 20 steals at the end of your draft.
Yep. The Mariners active again, or the Mariners ever not active? And their catching situation has gotten a little more confusing, and honestly, it was a little bit confusing from a fantasy perspective coming into the winter. It's not entirely clear what you make of Mike Zunino. And now they bring in Carlos Ruiz, who admittedly, I think at this point, is a backup catcher. But he's a backup catcher with a pretty specific skill set. He's a guy who can hit lefties. He is a guy that obviously pitchers really like. He's not somebody that any manager is ever going to hesitate to use. So what does that do to Zunino's value for you? And don't forget, they've also still got Sucre.
Yeah, it puts pressure on Zunino. Because, as you said, he's a guy that managers like. He's a guy that pitchers will like enjoy throwing to. He can hit for a decent average. I feel like they go into spring training, you know, Zunino 1, Ruiz 2. If Zunino doesn't get off to a good start, and that's totally possible looking at his career numbers, then I could see them just slowly sliding more towards Ruiz, just as a guy that everyone on the team feels comfortable having out there. And when I say Zunino gets off to a slow start, that could be him not handling the position well defensively at the beginning of the season, or it could be him, you know, hitting 135 at the end of April or something like that. So, yeah, to me, it put a damper on that kind of small hope that Zunino has a breakout year. I've never been high on Zunino as high as other people were at the beginning of his career. There's so many strikeouts and the batting average is so low.
I mean, to me, a big part of the problem with Zunino and guys of his ilk is that when they're not going well, it looks so bad. You know, a Zunino good might be hitting 220, and hitting 220, he's actually helping your ball club. But that looks bad to start with, and there are people who are going to be frustrated with that to start with. And then a slump from that is 150, 160, and it's really tough for those guys to maintain regular playing time, because if they're a little off, it just looks so, so bad.
That's right, and I mean, you know, I can look at him. Last season, he had a 787 OPS. That's pretty good for your catcher. But then you look at those traditional numbers, and he's hitting 207, and that doesn't look so good. And it's, you know, borderline what people are willing to accept. And Ruiz has no power, but you can see how a team could get comfortable. You know, he hit 264 last year. He's a 266 career hitter. Like, if you're right, if he's just kind of, if Ruiz is plodding along around hitting 250, and Zunino's just striking out all the time, you know, Ruiz could just be so, I don't know, I just, to me, this is enough now that I wouldn't even want Zunino in a two-catcher league.
Ruiz is exactly the kind of player that, and I have heard it many times, and anybody who's been around a manager any length of time, you just know what the manager's going to say. You're going to show up, and he's going to start 3 out of 4 days, you're going to ask him about it, and the manager's going to say something like, well, he just gives you a professional at-bat. You just know what you're getting. He's the same guy every day. He's going to give you a good at-bat. And it's a non-answer, but he's the kind of guy that a manager will just find himself riding in and be comfortable with and not even think twice, and suddenly he's playing regularly. I have seen it. I think there's a decent chance you'll see it again.
Yeah, and if we even want to read into the timing of this, you know, they went out and got Ruiz right at the beginning of the offseason.
Yep.
And he's due a decent amount of money next year. So, I mean, this was something that the Mariners targeted and they wanted. This isn't like he was just hanging around at the end of the year and, you know, and they didn't have to pay him much money, so they just grabbed him, you know, in January. Like, this was a clear plan by the Mariners. So, I mean, they're already leaning towards Ruiz having some value to them just by the timing of when they went out and got him.
No, that's a really good point. And it's not the only move as they continue to sort of tweak around the edges of what was a pretty good club. They bring in Danny Valencia. I'm not entirely sure where Valencia plays. He's a guy who's so, his bursts are so good, but so hard to see coming that I've never been as high on Valencia as some people are, I think, just because he's the kind of guy I sort of feel like he has two good weeks and you pick him up and then you get his two bad weeks. But do you see an avenue where Valencia plays enough to be a valuable fantasy player?
I think I can. You know, he's like really improved in the last two seasons against right-handers. Like in the last two seasons, he has a 7.95 OPS against righties. That's pretty solid. And then he's always good against lefties. So, I mean, it's really how are the Mariners going to use him? And they've become a team that really seems to like platoons. So, I mean, the short answer is he's a platoon player, whether it's at a corner outfield spot or it's at first base. But, you know, he mostly plays against lefties, and then you can't have him in a mixed league. But they're unsettled enough right now at first base and in left field where I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if he hits well enough that he kind of takes over the lion's share of one of those spots. And I don't think he's a 10-team mixed league guy, but maybe borderline 12 and definitely in a 15. Like, over the last 2 years, he's a .288 hitter with an 822 OPS, and that's in, you know, almost 900 plate appearances. So that's a big sample size to not really be too lucky over that time. So I don't know. I watched him in Toronto when he kind of came out in 2015 and was really confused when they let him go, and he hit well enough last season. I don't know if he'll on opening day have a 100% of a job, but like of 100% at one position, but I could see it happening during the year. Let's just wait and see, because as you said, the Mariners are really active. Like, what else they do in the next couple months?
We get some news. We sort of move to the odds and ends portion of our conversation. The Cardinals will apparently play Matt Carpenter at first base. As far as his 2017 value, that doesn't really affect it. Could affect it down the line if he loses eligibility to other positions going forward. The real interest there, I think, is elsewhere in the infield. It would appear to me that the maybe the main beneficiary is a guy I've always liked, sometimes in spite of the data, Colton Wong. Also would seem to mean that Diaz is going to play regularly. Do you assess Wong any differently if there's apparently a door open for him now?
Yeah, I think we're back to Colton Wong sleeper. I don't think we've ever really moved. Maybe we got too optimistic at the start for 2015 drafts because, you know, people were really, like, they took his 2014 numbers and thought, okay, he's just going to keep trending up. And then he went too high in 2015 draft, disappointed everyone, and now everyone was out on him. I think we've gone full circle now. We're back to Colton Wong sleeper as a guy who we haven't seen him hit really for average yet, but, you know, maybe with some strides he could hit .265 for you and get you 20-something steals and a dozen home runs. And that, you know, with us looking for steals, that could be valuable, like, as a late-round second baseman. Do you feel like he's someone you would target in the later rounds of a mixed league draft?
I do. Again, I like Wong a lot. I sort of, again, like I said, to some extent, flying in the face of the actual information that we have in front of us. But, you know, I just remember when Wong was drafted and the two things that people were confident that he would do were get base hits and steal bases. I mean, that his hit tool was really considered to be his most advanced tool. Now, look, I'm fully aware that was at the University of Hawaii, which isn't exactly the major leagues. But I guess my point is I'm still not entirely willing to give up on the idea that he could be a guy who gets base hits in the future. So, you know, I like him. He's a guy. Here's the thing. I think he's a guy that I like more than other people like. So to answer your question, yes, I would say that it is likely that he would be a guy I would target in the late rounds. The other guy that this seems to really affect is Diaz, who, you know, interesting guy. I mean, he got such hype coming out of his hot streak to start with. He still ends a year hitting 300. He still ends a year with some power. There's the whole selective endpoints thing. It's dangerous, but you take away just the first month. You take Diaz from May 1 till the end of the year. He hit 273. He hit 13 homers and 385 plate appearances. I'm open to the idea that that's what he is, that maybe he hits 270 with 20 home runs. He's 270, 20, 80 RBI, 80 runs, the occasional stolen base. Same question with some other guys. One, do you buy that? Do you think that's a pretty good read? And two, how high do you have him if that's the case?
Yeah, I think you might be right that he could end up being overrated going into the season. To put another spin on it, I mean, would we be completely shocked if Wong was more valuable next season, more productive than Diaz? I mean, from a fantasy
perspective, no, I would not.
Yeah, with Wong's ability to
because of the steals and just because of the kind of broad base of skills.
For sure. I mean, Diaz maybe, yeah, he drops off a little bit, maybe hits 275. Wong hits a little better and hits 270, and then there's not much batting average difference. There's a little more power maybe from Diaz and then way more steals from Wong, and then who knows where they'll end up in the lineup, you know. So, yeah, I mean, to me it means that the Cardinals have a lot of depth on their infield right now, so all of those players will be under a little bit of pressure to get off to solid starts. I would rather draft Diaz. I think his job's a little more secure than Wong. It'd be really easy for them to switch from Wong to Jed Jerko if Wong got off. And it'd be, if Wong got off to a slow start, it would kind of just be, you know, here we go again.
Right.
Whereas Diaz had at least had a really nice rookie season. So, but, I mean, Diaz is going to go in the middle rounds, if not earlier, I think, in a lot of drafts. And Wong is someone you could just grab at the end while you're passing up on Howie Kendrick. And
yep,
point because you'll know by the end of April probably whether, or maybe even 2 weeks into the season, whether you've kind of hit on something or not.
Yep, for the dollar value, I'd rather have Wong.
Yeah.
The Mets announced that Noah Syndergaard will not need surgery, that he is... presumably, he's going to be fine for spring training. I thought you asked a really interesting question because I kind of wondered the same thing myself. Is does that make you more or less confident? Because I think there's an argument to be made that if they said, look, he's going to have minor surgery, he's going to have some spurs cleaned out, it's a four-week recovery, and he'll be good to go by the beginning of spring training, which is something we've seen a bunch of pitchers have, you'd kind of... you have a little sigh of relief there. You'd say, okay, whatever was bothering him looks like it's fixed. We're moving forward. If it lingers there, if this thing's going to be there, I mean, he was really, really good last year. And I think it's important not to lose sight of that, the fact that even with this weird perception of disappointment, Syndergaard was one of the best starters and fantasy starters in the league. I think it's a fair question. I'm not sure what the answer is. Because I kind of almost would feel better if they said, look, we're fixing this and he's going to be fine. What's your answer to that question?
The fact that he's not having surgery, I think, makes me a little more optimistic.
Okay.
Because I'm going to go with maybe hyper-aggressive New York media as part of the reason that we were so concerned about him in the first place. And when I look at him even month to month, he had that hiccup in June, and that's where everybody got really fired up about him and a possible injury. 2.45 ERA in July, 2.84 in August, 2.83 in September. Like, there were no hiccups really the rest of the way. He has issues as far as holding base runners and things like that he needs to work on. But from a just pitching perspective, he was fine in the second half. And, you know, maybe this is a story that should have been a non-story all along. Now, it's hard to trust the Mets sometimes. I feel like they just don't have that great of a reputation always with decision-making on some of these things or public information on some of these things. But I think I'm going to choose to go optimistic and say that I'm cool with him as my ace. And, you know, we're crossing our fingers with all these starters when we hope for 30 starts. And I just don't feel like I need my fingers that much more crossed with him than a lot of the other ones.
He threw 183 and two-thirds innings last year. If I set repeating that as an over-under for him in 17, what are you taking?
I think I'm going to go over. I think I'm going to go over. And my concern, I guess, is I think if he stays healthy, he goes over. You could almost set it at 170, and for me, it would be the same decision because I feel like if you draft him as your ace, either there could be an injury problem and you get 100 or 120, or there's not. and, you know, he makes the next step and throws you 195, 205, something like that. So I'm going to cross my fingers a little bit. But like I said, you're crossing your fingers with all of them, and I'll take the over.
See, my worry is less that. My worry is less that it's 200 or 110, and more that it's kind of a similar year, and he misses a start here and misses a start there and feels some soreness and misses a couple of weeks, and that he comes in that 160, 170 range. And then you're starting to talk about, even if he's good, even if he is as good as he was this year, even if he's a little better, and he's just a guy that requires constant maintenance, you know, that starts becoming an issue of value relative to the other guys that might get drafted around when he does.
Yeah, no, it's definitely true. If there's one way that he can work around that a little bit, it's that if he throws 160 or 170, his strikeout total will be close to 200 or around 200. And then if you at least know some weeks, if you knew some weeks you didn't have him, you can use someone else who then gets you some strikeouts and maybe wins the odd game. So hopefully from that position you still get the, like, what you were expecting from an ace. So I don't know. I think part of it's also tied into the uncertainty, and we've discussed this earlier already in the offseason, but the uncertainty around what is David Price going to be in 2017, what will Kyle Hendricks be in 2017, and, you know, they're just, once we get past the four or five top starters, they're just, you know, it's a little bit of a pick your poison with all of these guys. At least I feel like I know when Syndergaard's pitching he's going to be great, including the strikeouts.
Yeah, that's fair. And one last topic before we call it a day. Glenn Perkins is confident that he's going to be good to go next spring. He is a guy who's really good when he's been healthy, but I'm not buying now. I'm open to the possibility that I'll be buying in the spring. What do you need to see? Do you need to hear he is our guy sometime in March, or are you willing to jump on him a little sooner than that?
No, I'm going to stay pretty skeptical until I see him, you know, pitch well in spring training and them say, you know, he could be our closer. I agree with you. When he's on and he's healthy, he's a fine closer to have. The Twins, I don't expect to be awesome next year, so you're kind of picking out a closer from one of the weaker teams, I think, in the American League. And, you know, just this year was such a washout for him. And I don't know. I'm going to stay skeptical. How about this? Would you rather lump him in with all those Angels relievers? Like, would you rather have one or two of the Angels relievers than Perkins? Would you rather have Perkins than all of them? Or, like, where would you compare him? Because that's kind of where he's going to come in, kind of those shot-in-the-dark guys later on.
Yeah, I think that I'd be more confident with one of the two Angels guys we talked about, just because we, you know, particularly with Bailey, you know, guys that I saw pitch effectively in 2016, I'm going to be a little more confident in, all other things being equal, than I am guys I didn't see pitch effectively at the end of 2016.
Yeah, I agree with that. I would probably take Perkins over Houston Street if I was drafting, you know,
yes,
before.
Agree with that. And it wouldn't be close,
the
honestly.
Spring training. Yeah, because I'm just not sure, even if Street's healthy, like, what he could be. Whereas, and Perkins, like we mentioned already, like, he's one of those, like we mentioned with Colt Wong, you'll know if you draft Perkins in an early draft in the offseason, like, you'll know by opening day whether you want to just drop him or not.
And the other difference between those two guys is Street could be healthy and not sniff a save opportunity all year. If Perkins is right, I'm pretty confident he'll be the guy in the ninth inning for them.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, that's the Fantasy 411 for this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, Fred Zinke, for taking the time to talk.